but genuinely startled.
No. You hate Nephilim, do you not? And besides, I imagine you warlocks have ways to guard against unwanted emotions. But for those like Charlotte, like Henry, if they knew the persona I presented to them was false, if they knew of my true heart, they might come to care for me. And then they would die, said Magnus.
Charlotte raised her face slowly from her hands.
And you've absolutely no idea where he is?
She asked for the third time.
Will is simply gone?
Charlotte. Jem's voice was soothing. They were in the drawing room, with its wallpaper of flowers and vines. Sophie was by the fire, using the poker to coax more flames from the coal. Henry sat behind the desk, fiddling with a set of copper instruments. Jessamine was on the chaise, and Charlotte was in an armchair by the fire. Tessa and Jem sat somewhat primly side by side on the sofa, which made Tessa feel peculiarly like a guest. She was full of sandwiches that Bridget had brought in on a tray and tea, its warmth slowly thawing her insides.
It isn't as if this is unusual. When do we ever know where Will is at night time? But this is different. He saw his family, or his sister at least. Oh, poor Will.
Charlotte's voice shook with anxiety.
I had thought perhaps he was finally beginning to forget about them. No one forgets about their family, said Jessamine sharply.
She sat on the chaise with a watercolor easel and papers propped before her. She had recently made the decision that she had fallen behind in pursuing the maidenly arts, and had begun painting, cutting silhouettes, pressing flowers, and playing on the spinet in the music room. Though Will said her singing voice made him think of church when he was in a particularly complaining mood.
Well, no, of course not, said Charlotte hastily. But perhaps not to live with the memory constantly as a sort of dreadful weight on you. As if we'd know what to do with Will if he didn't have the morbs every day, said Jessamine. Anyway, he can't have cared about his family that much in the first place, or he wouldn't have left them.
Tessa gave a little gasp. How can you say that? You don't know why he left. You didn't see his face at Ravenscar Manor.
Ravenscar Manor?
Charlotte was staring blindly at the fireplace.
Of all the places I thought they'd go. Pish and tosh, said Jessamine, looking angrily at Tessa. At least his family's alive. Besides, I'll wager he wasn't sad at all. I'll wager you he was shamming. He always is.
Tessa glanced toward Jem for support, but he was looking at Charlotte, and his look was as hard as a silver coin.
What do you mean? He said. Of all the places you thought they'd go. Did you know that Will's family had moved?
Charlotte started and sighed.
Jem. It's important, Charlotte.
Charlotte glanced over at the tin on her desk that held her favorite lemon drops.
After Will's parents came here to see him, when he was 12 and he sent them away, I begged him to speak to them just for a moment, but he wouldn't. I tried to make him understand that if they left, then he could never see them again, and I could never tell him news of them. He took my hand and he said, "Please, just promise me you'll tell me if they die, Charlotte. Promise me."
She looked down, her fingers knotted in the material of her dress.
It was such an odd request for a little boy to make. I had to say yes. So you've been looking into the welfare of Will's family? Jem asked. I hired Ragnall Fell to do it, Charlotte said. For the first 3 years. The fourth year he came back to me and told me that the Herondales had moved. Edmund Herondale, that's Will's father, had lost their house gambling. That was all Ragnall was able to glean. The Herondales had been forced to move. He could find no further trace of them.
Did you ever tell Will? Tessa said.
No,
Charlotte shook her head.
He had made me promise to tell him if they died, that was all. Why add to his unhappiness with the knowledge that they had lost their home? He never mentioned them. I had grown to hope he might have forgotten. He has never forgotten.
There was a force in Jem's words that stopped the nervous movement of Charlotte's fingers.
I should not have done it, Charlotte said. I should never have made that promise. It was a contravention of the law. When Will truly wants something, said Jem quietly, when he feels something, he can break your heart.
There was a silence. Charlotte's lips were tight, her eyes suspiciously bright.
Did he say anything about where he was going when he left King's Cross?
No, said Tessa. We arrived and he just up and dusted. Sorry, got up and ran. She corrected herself, their blank looks alerting her to the fact that she was using American slang.
Up and dusted, said Jem. I like that. Makes it sound like he left a cloud of dust spinning in his wake. He didn't say anything, no. Just elbowed his way through the crowd and was gone. Nearly knocked down Cyril coming to get us. None of it makes any sense, Charlotte moaned. Why on earth would Will's family be living in a house that used to belong to Mortmain in Yorkshire, of all places? This is not where I thought this road would lead. We sought Mortmain and we found the Shades. We sought him again and found Will's family. He encircles us like that cursed Ouroboros that is his symbol.
You had Ragnar Fell look into Will's family's welfare before, said Jem. Can you do it again?
If Mortmain is somehow entangled with them, for whatever reason... Yes, yes, of course, said Charlotte. I will write to him immediately.
There is a part of this I do not understand, Tessa said. The reparations demand was filed in 1825, and the complainant's age was listed as 22. If he was 22 then, he'd be 75 now, and he doesn't look that old. Maybe 40.
There are ways, Charlotte said slowly, for mundanes who dabble in dark magic to prolong their lives. Just the sort of spell, by the way, that one might find in the Book of the White. Which is why possession of the book by anyone other than the Clave is considered a crime. All that newspaper business about Mortmain inheriting a shipping company from his father, Jem said. Do you think he pulled the vampire trick?
The vampire trick? Echoed Tessa, trying in vain to remember such a thing from the Codex.
It's a way vampires have of keeping their money over time, said Charlotte. When they have been too long in one place, long enough that people have started to notice that they never age, they fake their own death and leave their inheritance to a long-lost son or nephew. Voila! The nephew shows up, bears an uncanny resemblance to his father or uncle, but there he is, and he gets the money. And they go on like that for generations sometimes. Mortmain could easily have left the company to himself to disguise the fact that he wasn't aging.
So he pretended to be his own son, said Tessa, which would also have given him a reason to be seen changing the direction of the company, to return to Britain and begin interesting himself in mechanisms, that sort of thing.
And is probably also why he left the house in Yorkshire, said Henry. Though that does not explain why it is being inhabited by Will's family, mused Jem.
Or where Will is, added Tessa.
Or where Mortmain is,
put in Jessamine with a sort of dark glee.
Only 9 more days, Charlotte.
Charlotte put her head back into her hands.
Tessa,
she said,
I hate to ask this of you, but it is, after all, why we sent you to Yorkshire, and we must leave no stone unturned. You still have the button from Starkweather's coat.
Wordlessly, Tessa took the button from her pocket. It was round, pearl and silver, strangely cold in her hand. You want me to change into him?
Tessa,
Jem said quickly,
if you do not want to do this, Charlotte, we would never require it.
I know, Tessa said,
But I offered, and I would not go back on my word.
Thank you, Tessa.
Charlotte looked relieved.
We must know if there is anything he is hiding from us. If he was lying to you about any part of this business, his involvement and what happened to the Shades...
Henry frowned.
It will be a dark day when you cannot trust your fellow shadow hunters, Lottie. It is a dark day already, Henry, dear.
Charlotte replied, without looking at him.
You won't help me then, Will said in a flat voice. Using magic, Magnus had built the fire up in the grate. In the glow of the leaping flames, the warlock could see more of the details of Will, the dark hair curling close at the nape of his neck, the delicate cheekbones and strong jaw, the shadow cast by his lashes. He reminded Magnus of someone. The memory tickled at the back of his mind, refusing to come clear. After so many years, it was hard sometimes to pick out individual memories, even of those you had loved. He could no longer remember his mother's face, though he knew she had looked like him, a mixture of his Dutch grandfather and his Indonesian grandmother. If your definition of help involves dropping you into the demon realms like a rat into a pit full of terriers, then no, I won't help you, said Magnus. This is madness. You know? Go home, sleep it off. I'm not drunk. You might as well be. Magnus ran both hands through his thick hair and thought suddenly and irrationally of Camille, and was pleased. Here in this room, with Will, he had gone nearly 2 hours without thinking of her at all. Progress. You think you're the only one who's ever lost anyone? Will's face twisted. Don't make it sound like that. Like some ordinary sort of grief. It's not like that. They say time heals all wounds, but that presumes the source of the grief is finite. Over. This is a fresh wound every day. Yes, said Magnus, leaning back against the cushions. This is the genius of curses, isn't it? It would be one thing if I had been cursed so that everyone I loved would die, said Will. I could keep myself from loving. To keep others from caring for me, it is an odd, exhausting procedure. He sounded exhausted, Magnus thought, and dramatic in that way that only 17-year-olds could be. He also doubted the truth of Will's statement, that he could have kept himself from loving, but understood why the boy would want to tell himself such a story. I must play the part of another person all day, each day, bitter and vicious and cruel. I rather liked you that way. And don't tell me you didn't enjoy yourself at least a little, playing the devil, Will Herondale. But I say it runs in our blood, that sort of bitter humor, said Will, looking at the flames. Ella had it, so did Cecily. I never thought I did, until I found I needed it. I have learned good lessons in how to be hateful over all these years, but I feel myself losing myself. He groped for words. I feel myself diminished, parts of me spiraling away into the darkness, which is good and honest and true. If you hold it away from yourself long enough, do you lose it entirely? If no one cares for you at all, do you even really exist? He said this last so softly that Magnus had to strain to hear him. What was that? Nothing. Something I read somewhere, once. Will turned to him. You would be doing me a mercy, sending me to the demon realms. I might find what I'm looking for. It is my only chance. And without that chance, my life is worthless to me anyway. Easy enough to say at 17, said Magnus, with no small amount of coldness. You are in love, and you think that is all there is in the world. But the world is bigger than you, Will, and may have need of you. You are a shadow hunter. You serve a greater cause. Your life is not yours to throw away. Then nothing is mine, said Will, and pushed himself away from the mantle, staggering a little as if he were really drunk. If I don't even own my own life. Who said we were owed happiness? Magnus said softly. And in his mind he saw the house of his childhood, and his mother flinching away from him with frightened eyes, and her husband, who was not his father, burning. What about what we owe to others? I've given them everything I have already, said Will, seizing his coat off the back of the chair. They've had enough out of me, and if this is what you have to say to me, then so have you, Warlock. He spat the last word like a curse, regretting his harshness. Magnus began to rise to his feet, but Will pushed past him toward the door. It slammed behind him. Moments later, Magnus saw him pass by the front window, struggling into his coat as he walked, his head bent down against the wind.
Tessa sat before her vanity table, wrapped in her dressing gown and rolling the small button back and forth in her palm. She had asked to be left alone to do what Charlotte had requested of her. It was not the first time she had transformed into a man. The Dark Sisters had forced her to do it, more than once. And while it was a peculiar feeling, it was not what fueled her reluctance. It was the darkness she had seen in Starkweather's eyes. The slight sheen of madness to his tone when he spoke of the spoils he had taken. It was not a mind she wanted to acquaint herself with further. She did not have to do it, she thought. She could walk out there and tell them she had tried and it had not worked. But she knew, even as the thought flickered through her mind, she could not do that. Somehow she had come to think of herself as bound with loyalty to the Institute's Shadow Hunters. They had protected her, shown her kindness, taught her much of the truth of what she was. And they had the same goal she did, find Mortmain and destroy him. She thought of Jem's kind eyes on her, steady and silver and full of faith. With a deep breath, she closed her fingers around the button. The darkness came and enveloped her, wrapping her in its cool silence. The faint sound of the fire crackling in the grate, the wind against the panes of the window, vanished. Blackness and silence. She felt her body change. Her hands felt large and swollen, shot through with the pains of arthritis. Her back ached, her head felt heavy, her feet were throbbing and painful, and there was a bitter taste in her mouth. Rotting teeth, she thought, and felt ill. So ill that she had to force her mind back to the darkness surrounding her, looking for the light, the connection. It came, but not as the light usually did, as steady as a beacon. It came in shattered fragments as if she were watching a mirror break into pieces. Each piece held an image that whipped by her, some at terrifying speed. She saw the image of a horse rearing back, a dark hill covered in snow, the black basalt council room of the clave, a cracked headstone. She struggled to seize and catch at a single image. Here was one, a memory. Starkweather dancing at a ball with a laughing woman, in an empire-waisted ball gown. Tessa discarded it, reaching for another. The house was small, nestled in the shadows between one hill and another. Starkweather watched from the darkness of a copse of trees as the front door opened and out came a man. Even in memory, Tessa felt Starkweather's heart begin to beat more quickly. The man was tall, broad-shouldered, and as green-skinned as a lizard. His hair was black. The child he held by the hand, by contrast, seemed as normal as a child could be. Small, chubby-fisted, pink-skinned. Tessa knew the man's name, because Starkweather knew it. John Shade. Shade hoisted the child up onto his shoulders, as through the door of the house spilled a number of odd-looking metal creatures like a child's jointed dolls, but human-sized, and with skin made of shining metal. The creatures were featureless, though oddly they wore clothes. The rough workman's overalls of a Yorkshire farmer on some, and on others plain muslin dresses. The automatons joined hands and began to sway as if they were at a country dance. The child laughed and clapped his hands. "Look well on this, my son," said the green-skinned man.
For one day I shall rule a clockwork kingdom of such beings, and you shall be its prince.
John!
Came a voice from inside the house. A woman leaned through the window. She had long hair the color of a cloudless sky.
John, come in! Someone will see, and you'll frighten the boy.
He's not frightened at all, Anne.
The man laughed and set the boy on the ground, ruffling his hair.
My little clockwork prince.
A swell of hatred rose in Starkweather's heart at the memory, so violent that it ripped Tessa free, sending her spinning through the darkness again. She began to realize what was happening. Starkweather was becoming senile, losing the thread that connected thought and memory. What came and went in his mind was seemingly random. With an effort, she tried to visualize the Shade family again and caught the brief edge of a memory. A room torn apart, cogs and cams and gears and ripped metal everywhere, fluid leaking as black as blood, and the green-skinned man and the blue-haired woman lying dead among the ruins. Then that, too, was gone, and she saw, again and again, the face of the girl from the portrait on the stairwell, the child with the fair hair and stubborn expression, saw her riding a small pony, her face set determinedly, saw her hair blowing in the wind off the moors, saw her screaming and writhing in pain as a steely was set to her skin and black marks stained its whiteness. And last, Tessa saw her own face appearing out of the shadowy gloom of the York Institute's nave, and she felt the wave of his shock ripple through her, so strong that it threw her out of his body and back into her own. There was a faint thump as the button fell out of her hand and struck the floor. Tessa raised her head and looked into the mirror over her vanity. She was herself again, and the bitter taste in her mouth now was blood where she had bitten her lip. She rose to her feet, feeling ill, and went over to the window, throwing it open to feel the cool night air on her sweaty skin. The night outside was heavy with shadow, there was little wind, and the black gates of the Institute seemed to loom before her, their motto speaking more than ever of mortality and death. A glimmer of movement caught her eye. She looked down and saw a white shape gazing up at her from the stony courtyard below. A face, twisted but recognizable. Mrs. Dark. She gasped and jerked back reflexively, out of sight of the window. A wave of dizziness came over her. She shook it off fiercely, her hands gripping the sill, and pulled herself forward again, gazing down with dread. But the courtyard was empty. Nothing moving inside it but shadows. She closed her eyes, then opened them again, slowly, and put her hand to the ticking angel at her throat. There had been nothing there, she told herself, just the rags of her wild imagination. Telling herself she'd better rein in her daydreaming or she'd end up as mad as old Starkweather, she slid the window shut.
Chapter 8 A Shadow on the Soul. Oh, just subtle and mighty opium, that to the hearts of poor and rich alike, for the wounds that will never heal, and for the pangs that tempt the spirit to rebel, bringest an assuaging balm, eloquent opium, that with thy potent rhetoric stealest away the purposes of wrath, and to the guilty man for one night givest back the hopes of his youth, and hands washed pure from blood. Thomas De Quincey, Confessions of an English Opium Eater.
In the morning when Tessa went down for breakfast, she found to her surprise that Will was not there. She had not realized how completely she had expected him to return during the night, and she found herself pausing in the doorway, scanning the seats around the table as if somehow she had accidentally glanced past him. It was not until her gaze came to rest on Jem, who returned her look with a rueful and worried expression of his own, that she knew that it was true. Will was still gone.
"Oh, we'll be back, for goodness sake," said Jessamine crossly, banging her teacup down in its saucer. "He always does come crawling home. Look at the two of you, like you've lost a favorite puppy."
Tessa shot Jem an almost guilty, conspiratorial look as she sat down across from him and took a slice of bread from the toast rack. Henry was absent. Charlotte, at the head of the table, was very clearly trying not to look nervous and worried, and failing.
"Of course he will," she said. "Will can take care of himself."
"Do you think he might have gone back to Yorkshire?" said Tessa. "To warn his family?"
"I don't think so," Charlotte responded. "Will has avoided his family for years, and he knows the law. He knows he cannot speak to them. He knows what he would lose."
Her eyes rested briefly on Jem, who was playing industriously with his spoon.
"When he saw Cecily at the manor, he attempted to rush to her," Jem said. "In the heat of the moment," said Charlotte. "But he returned with you to London. I am confident he will return to the Institute as well. He knows you obtained that button, Tessa. He'll want to discover what Stockweather knew."
"Precious little, really," said Tessa. She still felt obscurely guilty that she had not found more useful information in Starkweather's memories. She had tried to explain what it was like to be in the mind of someone whose brain was decaying, but it had been hard to find the words. And she remembered mainly the look of disappointment on Charlotte's face when she'd said she had discovered nothing useful about Ravenscar Manor. She had told them all of Starkweather's memories of the Shade family, and that indeed if their deaths had been the impetus for Mortmain's desire for justice and vengeance, it did seem as if it would be a powerful one. She had kept his shock at seeing her to herself. It was baffling still, and seemed somehow private. "What if Will chooses to leave the Clave forever?" Tessa said. "Would he return to his family to protect them?"
"No," Charlotte replied a little sharply. "No, I don't think he will do that."
She would miss Will if he were gone, Tessa thought with surprise. Will was always so unpleasant, and often so to Charlotte, that Tessa sometimes forgot the stubborn love Charlotte seemed to feel for all her charges. "But if they're in danger," Tessa protested, then fell silent as Sophie entered the room, carrying a pot of hot water, and set it down. Charlotte brightened at the sight of her.
"Tessa, Sophie, Jessamine," she said.
"Lest you forget, you all have training this morning with Gabriel and Gideon Lightwood."
"I cannot do it,"
Jessamine said immediately.
"Why not? I thought you had recovered from your headache."
"Yes, but I don't want it to come back, do I?"
Jessamine stood up hurriedly.
"I'd prefer to help you, Charlotte."
"I don't need your assistance writing to Ragnar Fell, Jessie. I'd really rather you took advantage of the training."
"But there's dozens of replies piling up in the library from the Downworld as we've queried about Mortmain's whereabouts,"
Jessamine argued.
"I could help you sort through those."
Charlotte sighed.
"Oh, very well."
She turned to Tessa and Sophie.
"In the meantime, you won't say anything to the Lightwood boys about Yorkshire or about Will. I could do without having them in the Institute right now myself, but there's no help for it. It's a show of good faith and confidence to continue the training. You must behave in all ways as if nothing is wrong. Can you do that, girls?"
"Of course we can, Mrs. Bramwell," said Sophie immediately.
Her eyes were bright and she was smiling. Tessa sighed inwardly, not sure how to feel. Sophie adored Charlotte and would do anything to please her. She also detested Will and was unlikely to be worried about his absence. Tessa looked across the table at Jem. She felt a hollowness in her stomach, the ache of not knowing where Will was, and wondered if he felt it too. His normally expressive face was still and unreadable, though when he caught her glance, he smiled a gentle, encouraging smile. Jem was Will's Parabatai, his blood brother. Surely if there were truly something to be concerned about where Will was involved, Jem would not be able to hide it, would he? From the kitchen, Bridget's voice rolled out in a sweet, high warble.
Must I go bound while you go free? Must I love a man who doesn't love me? Must I be born with so little art as to love a man who'll break my heart?
Tessa pushed her chair back from the table. I think I had better go and get dressed. Having changed from her day dress into gear, Tessa sat down on the edge of her bed and picked up the copy of Vatek Will had given her. It did not bring the thought of Will smiling to her mind, but other images of Will. Will bending over her in the sanctuary, covered in blood. Will squinting into the sun on the roof of the Institute. Will rolling down the hill in Yorkshire with Jem, splattering himself with mud and not caring. Will falling off the table in the dining room. Will holding her in the dark. Will, Will, Will. She threw the book. It struck the fireplace mantel and bounced off, landing on the floor. If only there were some way to scrape Will out of her mind, like scraping the mud off your shoe. If only she knew where he was. Worry made it worse, and she could not stop herself from worrying. She could not forget the look on his face as he had gazed at his sister. Distraction made her late to the training room. Fortunately, when she arrived, the door was open and there was no one there but Sophie, holding a long knife in her hand and examining it thoughtfully, as she might examine a dust mop to decide if there was still use in it or if it was time for it to be thrown away. She looked up as Tessa came into the room.
"Well, you look like a wet weekend, miss," she said with a smile. "Is everything all right?"
She cocked her head to the side as Tessa nodded.
"Is it Master Will? He's gone off missing for a day or two before. He'll be back, don't you fear?"
"That's kind of you to say, Sophie, especially as I know you are not over fond of him."
"I rather thought you weren't either," said Sophie. "Leastways, not any more."
Tessa looked at her sharply. She had not had a real conversation with Sophie about Will since the roof incident, she thought. And besides, Sophie had warned her off him, comparing him to a poisonous snake. Before Tessa could say anything in reply, the door opened and Gabriel and Gideon Lightwood came in, followed by Jem. He winked at Tessa before disappearing, closing the door behind him. Gideon went straight over to Sophie.
"Good choice of blade," he said,
faint surprise underlining his words. She blushed, looking pleased.
"So,"
said Gabriel, who had somehow managed to get behind Tessa without her noticing. After examining the racks of weapons along the walls, he drew down a knife and handed it to her.
"Feel the weight of the blade there."
Tessa tried to feel the weight of it, struggling to remember what he had told her about where and how it should balance in her palm.
"What do you think?"
Gabriel asked. She looked up at him. Of the two boys, he certainly looked more like his father, with his aquiline features and the faint shading of arrogance to his expression. His slim mouth curled up at the corners.
"Or are you too busy worrying about Herondale's whereabouts to practice today?"
Tessa nearly dropped the knife.
"What?" "I heard you and Miss Collins when I was coming up the stairs. Disappeared, has he?" "Not surprising, considering I don't think Will Herondale and a sense of responsibility are even on speaking terms."
Tessa set her chin. Conflicted as she was about Will, there was something about someone outside the Institute's small family criticizing him that set her teeth on edge. "It's quite a common occurrence, nothing to fuss about," she said. "Will is a free spirit. He'll return soon enough."
"I hope not," said Gabriel. "I hope he's dead."
Tessa's hand tightened around the knife. "You mean that, don't you? What did he do to your sister to make you hate him so much?"
"Why don't you ask him?" "Gabriel,"
Gideon's voice was sharp,
"shall we get to the instruction, please, and cease wasting time?"
Gabriel glared at his older brother, who was standing quite peaceably with Sophie, but obediently turned his attention from Will to the day's training. They were practicing how to hold blades today, and how to balance them as they swept them through the air without the blade drooping forward or the handle slipping from the hand. It was harder than it looked, and today Gabriel wasn't patient. She envied Sophie, being taught by Gideon, who was always a careful, methodical instructor, though he did have a habit of slipping into Spanish whenever Sophie did something wrong.
"Ay, Dios mío,"
he would say, pulling the blade from where it had stuck, point down in the floor.
"Shall we try that again?" "Stand up straight,"
Gabriel was saying to Tessa meanwhile, impatiently.
"No, straight, like this,"
he demonstrated. She wanted to snap at him that she, unlike him, had not had a lifetime of being taught how to stand and move. That shadow hunters were natural acrobats, and she was nothing of the sort. She said, "I'd like to see you learn how to manage sitting and standing up straight in stays and petticoats and a dress with a foot's worth of train."
"So would I,"
said Gideon from across the room.
"Oh, by the angel,"
said Gabriel, and he took her by the shoulders, flipping her around so she stood with her back to him. He put his arms around her, straightening her spine, arranging the knife in her hand. She could feel his breath on the back of her neck, and it made her shiver, and filled her with annoyance. If he was touching her, it was only because he presumed he could, without asking, and because he thought it would irritate Will. "Let me go," she said under her breath.
"This is part of your training," said Gabriel in a bored voice. "Besides, look at my brother and Miss Collins. She isn't complaining."
She glanced across the room at Sophie, who seemed earnestly engaged in her lesson with Gideon. He was standing behind her, one arm around her from the back, showing her how to hold a needle-tipped throwing knife. His hand was gently cupped around hers, and he appeared to be speaking to the back of her neck, where her dark hair had escaped from its tight chignon and curled becomingly. When he saw Tessa looking at them, he flushed. Tessa was amazed. Gideon Lightwood, blushing? Had he been admiring Sophie? Apart from her scar, which Tessa barely noticed anymore, she was lovely. But she was a mundane and a servant, and the Lightwoods were awful snobs. Tessa's insides felt suddenly tight. Sophie had been treated abominably by her previous employer. The last thing she needed was some pretty shadow hunter boy taking advantage of her. Tessa looked around, about to say something to the boy with his arms around her, and stopped. She had forgotten that it was Gabriel beside her, not Jem. She had grown so used to Jem's presence, the ease with which she could converse with him, the comfort of his hand on her arm when they walked, the fact that he was the only person in the world now she felt she could say absolutely anything to. She realized with surprise that, though she had just seen him at breakfast, she missed him, with what felt almost like an ache inside. She was so caught up in this mixture of feelings, missing Jem, and a sense of passionate protectiveness over Sophie, that her next throw went wide by several feet, flying by Gideon's head and bouncing off the windowsill. Gideon looked calmly from the fallen knife to his brother. Nothing seemed to bother him, not even his own near decapitation.
"Gabriel, what is the problem exactly?"
Gabriel turned his gaze on Tessa.
"She won't listen to me," he said spitefully. "I can't instruct someone who won't listen." Maybe if you were a better instructor, she'd be a better listener. And maybe you would have seen the knife coming, said Gabriel. If you paid more attention to what's going on around you and less to the back of Miss Collins' head.
So even Gabriel had noticed, Tessa thought, as Sophie blushed. Gideon gave his brother a long, steady look. She sensed there would be words between the two of them at home. Then turned to Sophie and said something in a low voice, too low for Tessa to hear.
"What's happened to you?"
she said under her breath to Gabriel, and felt him stiffen.
"What do you mean?"
"You're usually patient," she said. "You're a good teacher, Gabriel, most of the time. But today you're snappish and impatient and..." She looked down at his hand on her arm. "Improper." He had the good grace to release her, looking ashamed of himself.
"A thousand pardons. I should not have touched you like that."
"No, you shouldn't. And after the way you criticize Will..." He flushed along his high cheekbones.
"I've apologized, Miss Gray. What more do you want of me?"
"A change in behavior, perhaps? An explanation of your dislike of Will?"
"I've told you. If you wish to know why I dislike him, you can ask him yourself."
Gabriel whirled and stalked out of the room. Tessa looked at the knives stuck into the wall and sighed. "So ends my lesson."
"Try not to be too put out," said Gideon,
approaching her with Sophie by his side. It was very odd, Tessa thought. Sophie usually seemed uneasy around men, any men, even gentle Henry. With Will, she was like a scalded cat, and with Jem, blushing and watchful. But beside Gideon, she seemed... well, it was hard to define, but it was most peculiar.
"It's not your fault he is like this today," Gideon went on.
His eyes on Tessa were steady. This close up, she could see that they were not precisely the same color as his brother's. They were more of a gray-green, like the ocean under a cloudy sky.
"Things have been difficult for us at home with Father. And Gabriel is taking it out on you, or really anyone who happens to be nearby."
"I'm most sorry to hear that. I hope your father is well," murmured Tessa, praying she would not be stricken down on the spot for this blatant falsehood.
"I suppose I had better go off to my brother,"
said Gideon without answering her question.
"If I do not, he will take the carriage and leave me stranded. I hope to have him back to you at our next session in a better humor."
He bowed to Sophie, then Tessa.
"Miss Collins? Miss Gray?"
And he was gone, leaving both girls looking after him in mingled confusion and surprise. With the training session mercifully over, Tessa found herself hurrying to change back into her ordinary clothes, and then to lunch, eager to see if Will had returned. He hadn't. His chair, between Jessamine and Henry, still sat empty. But there was someone new in the room. Someone who made Tessa stop short at the doorway, trying not to stare. A tall man. He sat near the head of the table beside Charlotte, and was green. Not a very dark green. His skin had a faint greenish sheen to it, like light reflecting off the ocean. And his hair was snowy white. From his forehead curled two small, elegant horns.
"Miss Tessa Gray," said Charlotte, making the introductions. "This is the High Warlock of London, Ragnar Fell. Mr. Fell, Miss Gray."
After murmuring that she was delighted to meet him, Tessa sat down at the table beside Jem, diagonally from Fell, and tried not to stare at him out of the corner of her eye. As Magnus's cat's eyes were his warlock's mark, Fell's would be his horns and tinted skin. She couldn't help being fascinated by downworlders still, warlocks in particular. Why were they marked, and she wasn't?
"What's on the carpet then, Charlotte?" Ragnar was saying. "Did you really call me out here to discuss dark doings on the Yorkshire moors?" I was under the impression that nothing of great interest ever happened in Yorkshire. In fact, I was under the impression that there was nothing in Yorkshire except sheep and mining.
So you never knew the Shades?
Charlotte inquired.
The warlock population of Britain is not so large.
I knew them. As Fel sawed into the ham on his plate, Tessa saw that he had an extra joint to each finger. She thought of Mrs. Black, with her elongated, taloned hands, and repressed a shudder. Shade was a little mad, with his obsession with clockwork and mechanisms. Their death was a shock to Downworld. The ripples of it went through the community, and there was even some discussion of vengeance, though none, I believe, was ever taken. Charlotte leaned forward. Do you remember their son, their adopted child? I knew of him. A married warlock couple is rare. One who adopts a human child from an orphanage is rarer still. But I never saw the boy. Warlocks, we live forever. A gap of 30, even 50 years between meetings is not unusual. Of course, now that I know what the boy grew up to be, I wish I had met him. Do you think there is value in attempting to discover who his true parents were? Certainly, if it can be discovered. Whatever information we can glean about Mortmain could be useful. I can tell you he gave himself that name, said Fel. It sounds like a shadow hunter name. It is the sort of name someone with a grudge against Nephilim and a dark sense of humor would take. Mortmain.
Hand of Death,
supplied Jessamine, who was proud of her French.
It does make one wonder, said Tessa, if the Clave had simply given Mortmain what he wanted, reparations, would he still have become what he did? Would there ever have been a pandemonium club at all?
Tessa, Charlotte began, but Ragnar fell, waved her silent. He gazed amusedly down the table at Tessa.
You're the shape-changer, aren't you? He said. Magnus Bane told me about you. No mark on you at all, they say.
Tessa swallowed and looked him straight in the eye. They were discordantly human eyes, ordinary in his extraordinary face.
No, no mark.
He grinned around his fork.
I do suppose they've looked everywhere.
I'm sure Will's tried, said Jessamine in a bored tone.
Tessa's silverware clattered to her plate. Jessamine, who had been mashing her peas flat with the side of her knife, looked up when Charlotte let out an aghast,
Jessamine!
Jessamine shrugged.
Well, he's like that.
Fel turned back to his plate with a faint smile on his face.
I remember Will's father. Quite the ladies' man he was. They couldn't resist him. Until he met Will's mother, of course. Then he threw it all in and went to live in Wales, just to be with her. What a case he was.
He fell in love, said Jem. It isn't that peculiar.
Fell into it, said the warlock, still with the same faint smile. Hurtled into it is more like. Headlong crashed into it. Still, there are always some men like that. Just one woman for them, and only she will do, or nothing.
Charlotte looked over at Henry, but he appeared completely lost in thought, counting something, though who knew what, off on his fingers. He was wearing a pink and violet waistcoat today, and had gravy on his sleeve. Charlotte's shoulders slumped visibly, and she sighed.
Well, she said. By all accounts, they were very happy together. Until they lost two of their three children, and Edmund Herondale gambled away everything they had, said Fel. But I imagine you never told young Will about that.
Tessa exchanged a glance with Jem. My sister is dead, Will had said. They had three children then, she said. Will had two sisters?
Tessa, please.
Charlotte looked uneasy.
Ragnar, I never hired you to invade the privacy of the Herondales or Will. I did it because I had promised Will I would tell him if harm came to his family.
Tessa thought of Will. A 12-year-old Will clinging to Charlotte's hand, begging to be told if his family died. Why run? She thought for the 100th time. Why put them behind you? She had thought perhaps he did not care, but clearly he had cared, cared still. She could not stop the tightening at her heart as she thought of him calling out for his sister. If he loved Cecily as she had once loved Nate. Mortmain had done something to his family, she thought, as he had to hers. That bound them to each other in a peculiar way, she and Will, whether he knew it or not. Whatever it is that Mortmain has been planning, she heard herself say, he has been planning it a long time since before I was born, when he tricked or coerced my parents into making me. And now we know that years ago he involved himself with Will's family and moved them to Ravenscar Manor. I fear we are like chess pieces he slides about a board, and the outcome of the game is already known to him. That is what he desires us to think, Tessa, said Jem. But he is only a man, and each discovery we make about him makes him more vulnerable. If we were no threat, he would not have sent that automaton to warn us off. He knew exactly where we would be. There is nothing more dangerous than a man bent on revenge, said Ragnar. A man who has been bent on it for nearly 70 years, who has nurtured it from a tiny, poisonous seed to a living, choking flower. He will see it through, unless you end him first. Then we will end him, said Jem shortly.
It was as close to a threat as Tessa had ever heard him make.
Tessa looked down at her hands. They were a paler white than they had been when she lived in New York, but they were her hands, familiar, the index finger slightly longer than the middle one, the half-moons of her nails pronounced. I could change them, she thought. I could become anything, anyone. She had never felt more mutable, more fluid, or more lost.
Indeed,
Charlotte's tone was firm.
Ragnar, I want to know why the Herondale family is in that house that belonged to Mortmain, and I want to see to it that they are safe. And I want to do it without Benedict Lightwood or the rest of the Clave hearing about it.
I understand. You want me to look out for them as quietly as possible, while also making inquiries regarding Mortmain in the area. If he moved them there, it must have been for a purpose.
Charlotte exhaled.
Yes.
Ragnar twirled his fork.
That will be expensive.
Yes,
Charlotte said.
I am prepared to pay.
Fel grinned.
Then I am prepared to endure the sheep.
The rest of the lunch passed in awkward conversation, with Jessamine moodily destroying her food without eating it, Jem unusually quiet, Henry muttering equations to himself, and Charlotte and Fel finalizing their plans for the protection of Will's family. As much as Tessa approved of the idea, and she did, there was something about the warlock that made her uncomfortable in a way Magnus never had. And she was glad when lunch was over and she could escape to her room with a copy of The Tenant of Wildfell Hall. It was not her favorite of the Bronte sisters' books. That honor went to Jane Eyre, and then Wuthering Heights, with Tenant a distant third. But she had read the other two so many times that no surprises lay between the pages, only phrases so familiar to her they had become like old friends. What she really wanted to read was A Tale of Two Cities, but Will had quoted Sidney Carton to her enough times that she was afraid that picking it up would make her think of him, and make the weight of her nervousness greater. After all, It was never Darnay he quoted, only Sydney, drunk and wrecked and dissipated. Sydney, who died for love. It was dark out, and the wind was blowing gusts of light rain against the window panes, when the knock came at her door. It was Sophie, carrying a letter on a silver tray.
"A letter for you, miss."
Tessa put the book down in astonishment.
"Mail for me?"
Sophie nodded and came closer, holding out the tray.
"Yes, but it doesn't say who it's from. Miss Lovelace almost snatched it, but I managed to keep it from her, nosy thing."
Tessa took the envelope. It was addressed to her, indeed, in a slanting, unfamiliar hand, printed on heavy, cream-colored paper. She turned it over once, began to open it, and caught sight of Sophie's wide-eyed, curious gaze reflected in the window. She turned and smiled at her. "That will be all, Sophie," she said. It was the way she had read heroines dismissing servants in novels, and it seemed to be correct. With a disappointed look, Sophie took her salver and retired from the room. Tessa unfolded the letter and spread it out on her lap.
"Dear sensible Miss Gray, I write to you on behalf of a mutual friend, one William Herondale. I know that it is his habit to come and go, most often go, from the Institute as he pleases, and that therefore it may be some time before any alarm is raised at his absence. But I ask you, as one who holds your good sense in esteem, not to assume this absence to be of the ordinary sort. I saw him myself last night, and he was, to say the least, distraught when he left my residence. I have reason for concern that he might do himself an injury, and therefore I suggest that his whereabouts be sought, and his safety ascertained. He is a difficult young man to like, but I believe you see the good in him, as I do, Miss Gray, and that is why I humbly address my letter to you. Your servant, Magnus Bain. Postscript. If I were you, I would not share the contents of this letter with Mrs. Bramwell. Just a suggestion. M.B.
Though reading Magnus's letter made her feel as if her veins were full of fire, somehow Tessa survived the rest of the afternoon and dinner as well without, she thought, betraying any outward sign of her distress. It seemed to take Sophie an agonizingly long time to help her out of her dress, brush her hair, stoke the fire, and tell her the day's gossip. Cyril's cousin worked in Lightwood's house and had reported that Tatiana, Gabriel and Gideon's sister, was due to return from her honeymoon on the continent with her new husband any day now. The household was in an uproar, as she was rumored to have a most unpleasant disposition. Tessa muttered something about how she must take after her father that way. Impatience made her voice a croak, and Sophie was only just prevented from rushing out to get her a tisane of mint by Tessa's insistence that she was exhausted and needed sleep more than she needed tea. The moment the door shut behind Sophie, Tessa was on her feet, shimmying out of her night clothes and into a dress, lacing herself up as best she could, and throwing a short jacket on over the top. After a cautious glance out into the corridor, she slipped out of her room and across the hall to Jem's door, where she knocked as quietly as she could. For a moment, nothing happened, and she had the fleeting worry that he had already gone to sleep. But then the door flew open, and Jem stood on the threshold. She had clearly caught him in the middle of readying himself for bed. His shoes and jacket were off, his shirt open at the collar, his hair an adorable, rumpled mess of silver. She wanted to reach out and smooth it down. He blinked at her.
"Tessa?"
Without a word, she handed him the note. He glanced up and down the corridor, then gestured her inside the room. She shut the door behind him as he read Magnus's scrawl once, and then again, before balling it up in his hand, the crackling paper loud in the room.
"I knew it," he said.
It was Tessa's turn to blink.
"Knew what?" "That this wasn't an ordinary sort of absence.
He sat down on the trunk at the foot of his bed and shoved his feet into his shoes.
I felt it. Here.
He put his hand over his chest.
I knew there was something strange. I felt it like a shadow on my soul.
You don't think he'd really hurt himself, do you?
Hurt himself? I don't know. Put himself in a situation where he might be hurt.
Jem stood up.
I should go. Don't you mean we? You weren't thinking of going looking for Will without me, were you?
She asked archly. And when he said nothing, she said,
That letter was addressed to me, James. I didn't have to show it to you.
He half closed his eyes for a moment, and when he opened them, he was smiling crookedly.
James, he said. Ordinarily, only Will calls me that.
I'm sorry.
No, don't be. I like the sound of it on your lips.
Lips. There is something strangely, delicately indelicate about the word, like a kiss itself. It seemed to hover in the air between them while they both hesitated.
But it's Jem, Tessa thought in bewilderment.
Jem? Not Will, who could make her feel as if he were running his fingers along her bare skin just by looking at her.
You're right, Jem said, clearing his throat. Magnus would not have sent the letter to you, had he not intended you to be part of searching for Will. Perhaps he thinks your power would be useful. In either case,
he turned from her, going to his wardrobe and flinging it open.
Wait for me in your room. I will be there momentarily.
Tessa wasn't sure if she nodded. She thought she had. And moments later she found herself back in her bedroom, leaning against the door. Her face felt hot, as if she had stood too close to a fire. She looked around. When had she started to think of this room as her bedroom? The big, grand space, with its mullioned windows and softly glowing witch-light tapers, was so unlike the tiny box room she had slept in the flat in New York, with its puddles of wax on the bedside table, caused by her staying up all night reading by candlelight, and the cheap wooden-framed bed with its thin blankets. In the winter, the windows, ill-seated, would rattle in their frames when the wind blew. A soft knock on the door drew her out of her reverie, and she turned, flinging it open to find Jem on the threshold. He was fully dressed in Shadowhunter gear, the tough, leather-looking black coat and trousers, the heavy boots. He put a finger to his lips and gestured for her to follow him. It was probably 10 o'clock at night, Tessa guessed, and the witch light was burning low. They took a curious, winding path through the corridors, not the one she was used to taking to get to the front doors. Her confusion was answered when they reached a door set at the end of a long corridor. There was a rounded look to the space they stood in, and Tessa guessed they were probably inside one of the Gothic towers that stood at each corner of the Institute. Jem pushed the door open and ushered her in after him. He closed the door firmly behind them, slipping the key he had used back into his pocket.
This, he said, is Will's room.
Gracious, Tessa said. I've never been in here. I was starting to imagine he slept upside down, like a bat. Jem laughed and went past her, over to a wooden bureau and began to rummage through the contents on top of it, as Tessa glanced around. Her heart was beating fast, as if she were seeing something she wasn't meant to see, some secret, hidden part of Will. She told herself not to be silly. It was just a room, with the same heavy, dark furniture as all the other Institute rooms. It was a mess, too. Covers kicked down to the foot of the bed, clothes draped over the backs of chairs, teacups half full or liquid not yet cleared away, balanced precariously on the nightstand. And everywhere, books. Books on the side tables, books on the bed, books in stacks on the floor, books double-lined in shelves along the walls. As Jem rummaged, Tessa wandered to the shelves and looked curiously at the titles. She was not surprised to find that they were almost all fiction and poetry. Some were titles in languages she couldn't read.
She recognized Latin and the Greek alphabet. There were also books of fairy tales, The Arabian Nights, James Payne's work, Anthony Trollope's Vicar of Bullhampton, Thomas Hardy's Desperate Remedies, a pile of Wilkie Collins, The New Magdalen, The Law and the Lady, The Two Destinies, and a new Jules Verne novel titled Child of the Cavern that she itched to get her hands on. And then, there it was, a tale of two cities. With a rueful smile, she reached to take it from the shelf. As she lifted it, several scrawled-on papers that had been pressed between the covers fluttered to the floor. She knelt to pick them up, and froze. She recognized the handwriting instantly. It was her own. Her throat tightened as she thumbed through the pages. "Dear Nate," she read, "I tried to change today and failed. It was a coin they gave me, and I could get nothing from it. Either it was never owned by a person, or my power is weakening. I would not care, but that they whipped me. Have you ever been whipped before? No, a silly question. Of course you haven't. It feels like fire being laid in lines across your skin. I am ashamed to say I cried, and you know how I hate to cry. And, dear Nate, I missed you so much today, I thought I would die. If you are gone, there is no one in the world who cares if I am dead or alive. I feel myself dissolving, vanishing into nothingness. For if there is no one in the world who cares for you, do you really exist at all?" Those were the letters she had written her brother from the dark house.